Okay, welcome on this very nice summer morning. Perfect time for perfect weather for bicycle riding. And so we decided last time that it might be interesting to look at primitives for controlling concurrency. And we will use an idealized POSIX thread, a collection of POSIX thread primitives. POSIX threads are more complicated than the primitives there are more complicated than those which I will present here, and at some point I will kind of indicate where and what it is. So, in principle, it is a virtual machine what we kind of design or extend, and so we may again consider our infrastructure and the data structures provided by the runtime system. So definitely we will need a code store. This is C. And we will also have a heap with a new pointer. And then besides that, and the idea is, as usual, that heap cells may contain basic values or addresses, and globals, so that is perhaps a particular thing, may be stored directly here in this portion, at the beginning of this memory. And then there is the new pointer points to the first free memory cell, and that allows us to use the malloc. Now for the stack, somehow is kind of, then this is an auxiliary data structure, which sits in some sense, so we are not so precise in that respect, where the stack sits inside the memory, because it's not a single stack, but it's a multiple stack. So we need one stack for each thread. And in some sense, it is like that a stack could be considered. So one possibility to implement it is whenever a thread is created, you provide it with a block of memory. And this block of memory is hosts the runtime stack of this thread. And that means as soon as your stack space is exhausted, the thread will crash. And that is, the question is whether we will do it in this way or whether we will use a different memory management that is a matter of debate, and we will discuss that. But in principle, it is like that. There is a set of states. So this is a set of stacks, not of states. And that set of stacks is this data structure here. And we have a current, one of these stacks is a current stack. And the current stack has the stack pointer points to the top of the current stack. And there's a frame pointer. Okay, so that's this. And perhaps we will later use extra data structures inside our memory, which for maintaining the multiple threads. Okay? And that is, from our experience with Prolog or functional languages, we would appreciate if the address spaces of H and each stack are distinct, so that we could kind of have, so that would make things clearer. But that is not the way how it is done in C. In C, there is one address space, and looking at the address, you do not know whether it is a stack address or whether it is a heap address. So having distinct address spaces could also allow us to reuse the same address in the heap and in the stack and in the code and some and such things. But that is also not the way how it is in C. So in C, the addresses in some sense are unique. So you have one address, and that says speaks about something, and it is so it is not so that there is that you have separate address spaces. So that is therefore our that makes implementations of C a little bit brittle. So the question is whether the programmer notices that address spaces are not are kind of whether there's a joint address space. Well, and indeed, so if we use the address, say the address 5, here and there and there and there, then this is a C programmer could detect it because there could be because a pointer to one of these memory cells could be exported everywhere, could be written to the heap and read at some other thread. So one thread could have a pointer to the stack of another thread, and that is and by that, if we use the number 5 as an address in the stacks of all kind of different threads, then a thread would not know whether this 5 is a 5 of its own stack or a 5 of another thread's stack. So therefore, this is a way how. So since such kind of pointers are possible, or at least not forbidden by C and POSIX and thread and the multi-threaded extension of C, so we cannot use reuse the same address space for each stack. So that is one of the nasty things which we have to take into account. And now then there is one thing, wanted to have a smooth extension of C. And now if you have this multi-threaded thing with these multiple stacks, the question is, what do we do with the extreme pointer? So we could use, if we had kind of for each thread, if we had kind of set a block, so to speak, a bounding block, then we could kind of check for each thread whether the stack space is exhausted. So then that would mean something similar to the extreme pointer. But here we kind of perhaps want to ignore such phenomena therefore we throw away the extreme pointer completely. So it means we consider an implementation of C where there is no extreme pointer. So this means that this enter everywhere can be skipped because this was only meant to set the extreme pointer, and also the stack frame can be trimmed in that as organizational cells we only record the continuation address, the PC old, and the frame pointer of the caller, so the FP old, and nothing more. So this makes it a little bit shorter. So now, from now on, we have in every stack frame only two organizational cells, at least these two. Maybe we will use another one, but that is for different purposes. Okay, so no extreme pointer in the rest of this lecture. And I guess at some point I also discussed with you that sometimes that this check whether the extreme pointer is for the checking that the stack does not collide with the heap. Now, if it collides, what happens? So then you will very very quickly run into the program execution will go astray, and very quickly you will find a segmentation fault. So in that sense, having no extreme pointer would mean that you more often have segmentation faults. But that is, I think, the daily bread of a C programmer. If you didn't have sufficiently many segmentation faults per day, you feel unsatisfied as a C programmer. Oh, or did I say something wrong? Because it's for clean programming. It makes programming more secure and gives you, lets the program fail at the first point where you see something will go wrong. And it gives you kind of localization of the error. While if you have a segmentation fault, you have no localization of the error. You just have the message, something went wrong.
But here it doesn't matter where it went wrong.
Hmm?
But in this case it doesn't matter where it went wrong.
Well, it went wrong. Okay, now the ready. So let us now think about the multi-threaded environment. In a multi-threaded environment, you have multiple, as the title says, if it is multi-threaded, you have multiple threads, and that means they want to run. But typically, the number of CPUs which you have at hand are smaller than the number of threads. So somehow you have to maintain the threads which want to run or which could run but which currently do not run. And this is the ready queue. I guess if all of you have attended some kind of operating systems course, and I guess this is part of an operating system to maintain such ready queues. And so it's also kind of common. So also in POSIX threads, you kind of identify each thread by a thread ID. And thread ID is, I think it is kind of an abstract data type. And so in some sense you do not know what a thread ID really is. But it is unique for every thread. And by that you can identify the thread. But I guess the typical implementation of the concept of thread ID is just to use a number. This is already an interesting thing. Because, why? Because if you have multiple threads, any thread can produce new threads. And still this number must be unique. So this is a kind of shared resource somehow. What is the next thread ID? So you have kind of, this is, you could have, if you generate threads like hell, you could have congestion just on the problem, provide each new thread with a new thread ID. That is kind of, so you have kind of, could have races on just that thing, what is the next thread ID? And I guess that is there's another option that if you have 20 worker threads, that you kind of have 20 counters for, and use these kind of, you use pairs as thread IDs, first component, the counter, second component, the number of the counter. By that you can kind of eliminate this congestion. So at least if you have this number, unique number thing, then you are endangered to have this congestion. So that is kind of not so much a problem for us here, because in some sense the implementation which I will present to you is one which runs on a monoprocessor, on a single processor, and all the threads are only simulated. That is kind of the poor man's concurrency, if you like. So, but in principle, otherwise this concept of a thread ID should be or could be weakened to have these pairs. Okay, so by that you identify the thread. Then you need somehow a kind of table which contains all relevant information about the threads, and in particular the links, the thread IDs, to kind of a working set of important informations about a thread. Namely, for example, if the thread has been was not running, so somehow, and now you have the thread ID and you want it to run, then you kind of have to find out what was the execution state and how to continue. So for that you, and that is the handle for that is the thread ID. So therefore this thread table should contain all relevant information to restart an interrupted execution. So that is the thread table, and we will kind of later on figure out what information to store in the thread table. Okay. So that is these two things which we should which might be important for a thread, and then kind of at every point in time there could be a multitude of threads which want which could be executed, which are executable, but not everyone is running. So only as many can run as there are CPUs around, and that is, for all those potentially running threads, they should be kept in kind of a queue. This is the ready queue. And then there is if you think of a monoprocessor system, then there is one thread which is currently running. And this thread has also an ID, and the question is how do we get or where do we maintain that ID of the currently running thread, and this is, I called it, I propose to store that in a register. This is a CT, or current thread, the current thread register, which gives us the ID of the current thread. You could also use a global for it and store it there, but it should be a designated place where you can retrieve that information. And then there is there is a function also provided by POSIX thread to get the thread ID of the current thread. So this is the this function self. And by that a thread may inspect its own thread ID. It's similar to a particular method provided by the thread library. Thread class in Java. What is the method there? Current thread. So you could kind of, there's a static method, current thread, which you could call, and that gives you the object. So there you have objects, so which is the reference. You have a reference to the, and for the current thread object, The object of the current thread is you get it as a reference back by current thread. So there it is a thread and not a thread. But I think threads also have thread. I don't know. I think they... Well, but you have this current thread thing. Here you have this thread ID which you get by the self. And for that we kind of provide an instruction to implement it. And this simply pushes the current the content of the register CT on top of the stack. So that's it. Very simple. Clearly, and in POSIX thread, it's a library, so this self is not an atomic operation, but it is kind of implemented in C, and it just retrieves from a data structure where the current thread is stored, the current thread ID is stored, that value, and returns it. And here we do it by give native support by the virtual machine. Okay, and then now the remaining executable threads should be maintained in the ready queue. So we need a queue somewhere. And now the queue, what should the queue contain? Clearly, it should contain all the information for the threads. But that is a bit, yeah. We would like to have the queue as lightweight as possible. Therefore, we have this thread table containing that relevant information and maintain in the ready queue only the thread IDs. So this is easier. So by that, it's just a queue of ints, containing ints. And now this queue as a queue, so this queue is part of the runtime system. So this means the implementation of the virtual machine must provide an implementation of this queue. Conceptual, if in the thinking of POSIX threads as a library, this ready queue is also implemented in C. So it is somehow sitting, there is a C data structure which contains all the thread IDs. And this data structure provides us with two operations, and Q and DQ. And Q allows us to add a thread, to push a thread ID into the queue, and DQ allows us to retrieve a thread ID. Now it could be that the queue is empty, then the DQ would return a number which is not a thread ID, say minus one. So if zero is also a thread ID. Yeah, so minus one is for sure no thread ID, and then this is would give us kind of an error. Yeah, so here is kind of a picture how it looks like. So here the thread table containing all information for all threads. Then the current thread points is an index pointing to one particular entry. And then the ready queue contains also other things. And when I said ready queue, I kind of implicitly assumed that there is a queue-like discipline on the running threads. So that means the one which has been scheduled earlier, which has entered the ready queue earlier, will be executed first. You could put kind of other discipline, scheduling discipline onto the ready queue. For example, some priorities. And I guess that is one of those things which make life even more complicated if you put different priorities onto your jobs, because then it's not so clear what will always happen, at least in my perspective. This working with priorities and writing programs whose correctness depends on these priorities is very brittle programming. Okay, so here enqueuing something into the queue would kind of mean that we kind of push something, and dequeuing would kind of remove something. Yeah, and dequeuing means that the value of the ready queue will be put into the current. Will become the current thread. So this is the connection of the current thread and the ready queue. Dequeuing pushes, you can dequeue something from the ready queue only by putting it into the current thread, making it the current thread. Okay, so that's this one. And now, and that is the other thing which I already said, but here I have explicitly written it onto the slide. DQ may fail, and then it will return a value less than zero, say minus one. Okay, so now what kind of information should the thread table contain for every thread? So at least here I consider three informations as relevant. The first thing is, since the program counter, definitely, you need to know where to continue. And somehow then you have to identify the stack. But since the stack, so there is no global top of stack, and there is no, so you have to kind of provide a pointer to the stack, current stack frame, and to the top of the stack also. So that is the stack pointer. So these three registers seem natural and So these are seems to be the minimum which you need to recover continue with the execution of a thread. And so that means we provide an instruction. These three information we would store in the thread table. Now, if you interrupt the current thread, this means that you save these three register, frame pointer, PC, and stack pointer, into the TTAP. And where into the TTAP? Well, since you interrupt the current thread, you index it first by means of the register CT. And that is gives you the little subarray where you kind of place your information. Okay, and then when you kind of when you save the current thread state. Now it could be that you want to resume the thread state. That is, you made a DQ. You have a new thread in your current thread register, and then you want to recover the three registers FP, PC, and SP from the TTAP, and that you do by means of the restore. And it is just this one. So saving and restoring is thus can be easily implemented. Okay, And then, so that is these two kind of runtime functionalities which we would like to provide. Then there's another instruction which we want to realize. So that's kind of the first warm-up, the first thing which any multi-threaded system should provide. This is this instruction yield. So yield is also available in Java. And what does yield mean? It means that the current thread voluntarily says, okay, here I am at a point where I could continue, but if there is some other thread who might want to run, please let him, so it's a matter of politeness, so this other thread might run first. And what do we expect from that? So we expect from that the current thread saves its thread state, pushes its thread ID into the ready queue, and dequeues another one. Yeah, so that is the effect of the yield. So that is kind of we would implement it therefore in this way. We dequeue, or we could do it in, we could make it a little bit more clever in that we not interrupt any. Under all interrupt our computation by all means, but we first check if there is somebody else who wants to run. If nobody else is there, there's no point in interrupting the current and saving the current thread state. Yeah. So that is, we first dequeue. If there is something, then we interrupt. Otherwise, we simply continue. So if there is something, if we interrupt, then we save our current thread state by means of saving. We enqueue our current thread ID into the ready queue. And then we set the current thread of the one which we obtained from the dequeuing. Then we restore. We restore that state, and the state of that dequeued thread ID, and then continue. Yeah, so that would be kind of the way how we do it. But so here you see this in the picture was a little bit misleading. This one, that the result of the dequeue is not necessarily in the current thread, directly goes into the current thread ID. It might also go first into an intermediate register, into an intermediate variable of the runtime system, this little CT, then a little bit of execution is done, and only then it is put into the current, into the register CT. So once again, moving the result from DQ into CT is not a part of the DQ. So DQ is not a procedure, but it's a function. It returns a value which we could put anywhere, also, and in particular also into this capital CT. But also, if we decide differently, as we did here, we might put it in some intermediate register, intermediate variable as well. Okay, so that was the yield. Now, why did I kind of introduce this yield? In fact, it is as soon as you have not as many CPUs as threads, this yield is important, because you kind of must ensure that every thread eventually has the chance to run. Otherwise, there could be unfair program executions, and some threads may be deferred, maybe delayed in their computation forever, which might not be an desirable effect. So that is. In this, now, if we think again in the extreme that we have a single processor and we want to give every executable thread a fair chance to be completed. How can we do it? So that means, so a fair chance for every, giving every thread a fair chance means that every thread, former or later, must be scheduled for running, and every thread which is in the ready queue. So that means, so how can it happen that a thread which enters the ready queue will never be taken out? Well, this happens if there is one thread which runs forever and never gives up the CPU. Yeah, because it is a non-terminating program and it does not give up the CPU. So that means in order to prevent that, you should, every thread must be former, you must be guaranteed, not that every thread terminates, that might not be easily done, but at least that every thread, former or later, is interrupted. How can you enforce an interrupt to every thread? And there are several ways what one could do. The first one is the optimistic and cooperative view. And that means that every thread itself decides, so one kind of believes that the programmer is a cooperative person, and when it implements a thread, it builds into it calls to the function yield sufficiently often, so that non-termination of that particular thread does not incur unfairness, but kind of is gives other threads also a chance. So this is the in some sense, if you like, the optimistic view, and and it is easy to implement the yield we have provided, and the runtime system puts all the burden of the correct usage onto the programmer. And in fact, in the early days of Java, at least I don't know whether you ever have used that mode. I don't know whether it is even still available. There was something like green threads. You have ever used these? If you use these, I guess this was the default at some point. And that meant that maybe they have been completely abandoned. At that time, the threads ran somehow in the virtual machine, and you had to use the yield. Otherwise, you could kind of... each thread ran to completion before another thread had the chance to run. So that was, and you had to, so without yield, you could make very weird things. You could write non-terminating programs which behave not as they should. So that is one thing. So okay. So if we do not believe in this cooperative into the programmer and in cooperation, then we could kind of take precautions by the runtime system that there is a fairness. So one thing one could do is after every instruction, every thread is interrupted. So that one could do, but that's clearly a bit expensive. Because with every interrupt, you have a switch in the context, and that is not for free, to say the least. Not for free, because we have a test whether somebody else is running, and if somebody else is waiting, you have to kind of wrap three registers, put them into the table, take the three registers from the other thread and put them again in place and start the other thread. So that is kind of an extra, I would say, it slows down a factor of 10, the virtual machine. And that is kind of ignoring cache and such other problems, because by that, in principle, then everything kind of is a cache miss, and so it is a disaster. So that one would not like to have. So what one could kind of make it a bit cheaper by letting each thread switch not after every step, but let every thread do, say, 1,000 steps or 10,000 steps. You count to 10,000 and then you make this yield by the automatically inserted by the runtime system. That is possible, and that makes it the virtual. So then the overhead of this context switching is negligible because it's only every 10,000 steps. But you have to count to maintain the counter. Maintaining the counter is a cheap operation, but still you have to do it at every step. So every step is still slowed down a bit, every step of the virtual machine, because you have to kind of manipulate the counter and always check, is it already 10,000? You could provide perhaps some kind of operating systems or whatnot. Or you could use a... the other thing is that you could kind of use operating system support, saying... using an interrupt from the surroundings to let you wake up, not exactly after a fixed number of steps, but so that after some timer went finished or raises an alarm, you get the virtual machine gets an exception, and then the next it completes the current step and then takes the next step in a different thread. So that one could do, and that is kind of a viable way how to realize that. In some sense, it's similar to what the operating system itself would do. But we could also do a little bit something. We could kind of make the compiler in that sense smart, in that we say, okay, there is we statically insert the yield operation into the code at sufficiently many places. And sufficiently many means not after every instruction, that would be kind of a disaster, but at least into all cycles in the code. So what are cycles? How do I detect cycles in the code? Well, there is something like where... so we could do it in that way, that we say, at the beginning of every function body, we kind of place a yield. And also, when you have a jump, where you jump to a position which is earlier in the code than your current position. So if you jump ahead, then this will not cause cycles. But if you jump back, and that means you jump to an address which is smaller than your current address. Then you have, that would be at the end of a while, for example. And there you would kind of, at the body of a while, there you would kind of place a yield. So that would be one possibility how to do it. And one could also combine these two, that you count these kind of potentially dangerous situations, and every 1,000 of these you insert a yield. That would mean that only in these places you would increment the counter for the context switch. That means the counting and checking the counter would become much cheaper because you do it only in rare places. And then the cost of the context switch itself is then even a factor of 1,000 or what rarer. So by that you can decrease the overhead of context switching as much as possible and still maintain fairness. So this inserting of yields would kind of be like that. So we know where that is should be placed. So for example, if we have a while loop, and then we would place here this yield before jumping back to the condition. Yeah. And that kind of the effect is if then else would not cause context switches. Then this do whiles and as while loops would also have a context switch. Then if you do loop optimizations like loop unrolling, this would remove context switches because loop unrolling replaces a loop by a series of basic blocks without or if then else is, so there is no... there would be no jumping back, and so no context switch anymore. And then clearly, if I said if I jump back, then I would have a context switch, but I could that I, if I look at the how t- when I look at the translation, then we might consider the switches, and then there it makes a point, it makes a difference where we place created the jump table, in order to find out whether there is jumping back or not. But I guess there one simply, yeah, since there could be very general forms of switch statements, one probably simply would do the same, apply the same strategy here, that if we jump back, then we yield. Yeah. Good. And here, then, that is kind of the ultimate thing. We kind of we play in these places where a yield should state. We do not directly yield, but count to some number, say 100 or so, before we yield. Okay. So that is kind of now how we kind of do the scheduling if we have multiple threads which possibly could run. So now the question is, how do we generate? So the next thing is we have to provide code for generating a new thread. So this is here. How do we do it? So for that, in POSIX threads, there's something like POSIX, it's like a thread create. And that thread create is a function with a multitude of arguments. At least it has two. The first one is should evaluate to a function, and the second one to its argument. And then did I ask last time who has ever programmed with POSIX threads? So you know that there are more arguments if for the thread create, and I guess one is the size of the stack which you have to provide. And then I guess you also have, I think there's a fourth argument, providing priorities or so of the thread which you create. And so these two things, the priority and the stack size, I have cancelled. So it's a simplified way. So this thread creation, as like a malloc, and in C, every operation might fail. And so thread creation might fail. And then it might, so how can it fail? If it does not fail, then it will return a thread ID. And then if we assume the thread ID start with zero, then failing of thread creation should return a value, which is different from these. It is, so I decided that minus one is a good value. I'm not so sure what thread create in reality returns if it fails. Does it return null then? Is null a thread ID or is it not thread ID?
No, I guess null is also a negative value.
It's also a negative value? Yeah. And otherwise it returns, thread create returns the thread ID which is created. So the creator of a thread knows the thread ID of the thread which it has created, and by that can communicate with it. That is important. And for the created thread to learn about the thread which has created, you have to pass it the current thread ID by argument or something to inform the created thread about its ancestor. But that is up to the programmer. But by means of the thread create, at least allows to get hold of the created thread. And also the information whether that creation has succeeded or not. Now, if we want to generate code for that, then what do we have to do? Okay, so it is the classic, it is the thing which we have to envision now, the activities going on during thread creation and then implement it. So the first thing is we have to evaluate the arguments. Then we have to allocate. Now that is something new. The new thread lives on its own stack. So we have to create not just only, we do not have to allocate a new stack frame for that, but we have to create a new runtime stack and put the stack frame there. So this is this one. And then we have to generate a new thread ID, that's for sure. And that is, as I said, the thread counter, ID counter, is a global resource, which we have to access and find out, okay, what is the next thread ID, take it, increment the counter. So that should be an atomic operation, so that there is that the same thread ID is not given twice to two different threads. That would be kind of a bad idea. And then we have to, for this thread ID, we immediately have to provide an entry in the thread table. And then we insert an entry, and that means we also have to store the information about the stack frame and the top of the stack and all that in the thread ID and the PC, the current PC for that thread. And then we have to insert the new thread ID into the ready queue. And then as soon as it is kind of scheduled for execution, it takes its information out of the TTAP and starts running. So that is therefore what I proposed how we would do it. So here I kind of decided to... First I zero, then I one. This is a bit in the opposite order as we... I wonder whether we should do it in this ordering or in the other ordering. So at least we have to evaluate the two arguments and put their values on top of the stack, and then of our stack. And then we have to kind of get a new stack and initialize that by the relevant information, and then initialize the new thread. And this initialization of the new stack and of a new thread, for that we have no... So we provide two instructions for that, which we implement now. So this init stack needs, for that we need the ability of our runtime system to provide us with a new stack. So since our collection of stacks is maintained by the operating system, we could kind of ask the runtime system. So we could ask the runtime system to provide us, so to support a function which gives us a new stack, however, in which way soever the runtime system will realize this function. In the case of where P threads and the thread create there, there we say how large the stack space will be. So then this new stack simply is you use a malloc. This malloc provides you with a block of the appropriate size and it gives you with a pointer to it. So this is the creation of a stack. But here in our case, you cannot do it with a malloc. We might do it in a different way. So here we simply assume that the runtime system provides us with a new stack and puts the new stack, a reference to this new stack on top of the current stack. And also, if the thread creation, a stack creation has failed, it provides us with the value zero. So because stack creation may fail if memory is exhausted. Now then, okay, so that is the new stack thing. So this provides us with a reference to the bottom element of a stack. And then, so one element stack, and then we could kind of, so now the init stack would do the following. It checks if the stack creation has succeeded. If it has succeeded, it kind of takes the function stack minus one, and puts it so now I'm a little bit, what is this F? I'm a little bit nervous. What is this F? It has not been shown here. Well, so that is kind of the argument. So this value here is that what is on top of the stack, and that is the second argument. So this is the argument of the function. This is placed on the argument of the function is put in the bottom element of the stack. So that is this line. And now here I guess there's this minus one should be inside the bracket. So the minus one should be inside the bracket. On the address on top of it, we place this minus one. So why do we place minus one here? So this minus one is, this minus one here is the old frame pointer, and the old frame pointer is, there is no old frame pointer because this is the first stack frame of the created thread, so therefore is minus one. And this F here is kind of a fixed continuation address, which is kind of, which we will consider later. So it's a kind of, so this new stack initialization gives us the initial stack frame, the parameters, and the organizational cells of the first stack frame, and otherwise, so here we see what happens if stack initialization fails, then the stack is popped, the two elements are thrown away, and we return the two topmost, so there are three elements on top of the stack, and two of them are removed, and the element below is set to minus one. So here is the explanation now, what this continuation address F is. It points to a fixed piece of code, which is kind of responsible for the termination of a thread. So this means if that the newly created thread terminates, so then what to do? So then the activity which is to be done then is starts at this fixed code location F. Okay. So then, as we have no extreme pointer, so therefore we have only two organizational cells on the stack frame, and the return address, therefore, will not be stored at relative address minus three, but at relative address minus two. Okay. And also, as I said, there is no old frame pointer, so therefore we have there minus one in this particular place of the organizational memory cells. And by this minus one, we can also identify that we have reached the bottom of the, that we have that a threat evaluation has terminated. So now we have to, so that was kind of for the stack. Now comes the threat initialization. So how do we do the threat initialization? The first thing is, so we have to create this new threat ID, and we have to extend the threat table. And then we have kind of to start to put the new threat into the ready queue. So now for the, how do we get a new threat ID? So I said we need kind of a counter which kind of keeps track of the thread IDs which we have already have already been used. And this is this thread count. So for that we also offer, or I propose to offer, a new register to keep track of that. This is the thread count. Initially, this thread count has the value 0 corresponding to the thread ID of the main thread. And if there's no multi-threading, this thread ID will simply stay zero all the time. And before thread creation, this thread ID, thread counter is incremented by 1, and then we can take that counter and to obtain the new thread ID. So here is what this init thread should do. So on top of the stack, we have a reference to on top of the stack. We have a reference to the newly created stack, and then we have this other register TC containing the current thread count. So this is incremented first. So this is incremented, and then we put this thread count on top of the stack. This is what we return, and we initialize the thread table, but with what? So we first need record the address where the program execution should start. This is this should be the start address of the function which has been provided to the create, the thread create function. So this should be provided on the stack. Then additionally we need the stack pointer and the frame pointer. And the stack pointer and the frame pointer are the same. These are sitting currently on top of the stack. So they are sitting here. And below that, we expect the start address of the thread. And then these two elements will be popped and replaced by the thread ID. And additionally, this thread ID should be entered into the ready queue. So here is the code. If stack creation has succeeded, we increment the thread counter, then we initialize the thread table by placing the storing the the stack pointer and the frame pointer of the newly created thread there, and also the continuation, the start address of the code, which we expect one element below the top element. And then having done that, we pop the we pop the stack and return the thread ID there, and also enqueue this thread ID into the ready queue. Then I have only to think that here we the init stack. So this init stack so must kind of pop the stack also by one. Did we do it? Let me see. Ah, here. Ah, so that is indeed that I did not kind of, it's not so clear whether this picture here is correctly, is showing the situation correctly. In fact, the code here is, I think, the correct one. We pop the stack by one, the stack decreases, and that means the argument which was on top of the stack is popped. So here, therefore, the argument is popped, but it is replaced by the argument. Let me see. New stack increments the stack. I confused myself. The argument pointer is replaced by the pointer to the stack frame. So in that sense, really below this pointer to the new stack, we have the pointer to the code. So that is really this init stack really fits together with this init thread, so that since the argument has been squeezed out of the stack of the creator, we really have the pointer to the new stack on top of the code pointer. And then this init thread works well, correctly. So I'm relieved that the code is not buggy. So because this was an implementation which I did on paper, so I just dreamt up these implementations, and there you very easily can make mistakes. But we had a bachelor thesis recently where a female student implemented that inside the VAM. So I guess you will be able to make experiments with that, and then you can also check these instructions and whether they fit together to give an implementation of a program written in threaded C. So that is, in that sense, I was, and I asked her, she didn't find a bug in the implementation. So that is also a kind of a sanity check. So multi-threading is complicated for the programmer, it is also complicated for the implementer. So you very easily make mistakes there, and I kind of, maybe just to add one more stupid anecdote there. For a few years ago, I presented an implementation of semaphores in Java to the Informatic One course. Well, I don't know, who taught you which kind of Info One course did you attend? Who was your lecturer? Westermann, and who else? Is there no one with me? So at least I implemented it, the semaphore, by myself, using this wait and notify things, and so I played around. And I really needed, 5 to 6 attempts until it really worked. Because there's so very short code, but very easily completely messed up. And it's... One must be extremely careful and suspicious with when you see implementations of multi-threading. Yeah, it is always useful to be suspicious here. Okay, so once again, sorry that I repeat myself, but it is important. So we create the stack, we put an initial stack frame, so there is no call. But we use the name of the function to place it into the address, start address of the function, to place it in the TTAP, so that when context switch activates this thread, then immediately this function starts running. Okay, so that was kind of an optimization, that the call was kind of optimized the way, and in that we directly create the start address of the function, store the start address of the function in the TTAP. So that was starting of threads, and so that is the most important thing. So you have to start concurrency, otherwise you cannot make use of it. But at some points you also want to terminate threads. And there are termination of threads is not so trivial. Actually, I find it amazingly complicated, because there are two ways how you can terminate. Well, there are multiple ways what you could do. And so here we consider... So the question is, the first thing, will it terminate silently, or will it return a value? And so typically in C, a function returns a value. So therefore also a thread may return a value. And the question is, where does it return a value, and what happens to the value? So perhaps comparing this with the world of Java, so there you have this concept of a thread which runs and returns a no value. So when it finishes, it finishes. And there is something like a callable. So what is the execution? Is it execute or what? What a callable does when it runs? And it... Please louder. No, a callable. This is also an interface. So what is the method to be implemented by a callable? If it execute? And that returns a value, at least. So this makes a difference. So a callable will return a value. And so when you call a callable, you will have to do something when it once it terminates. So it's like I guess callable are more related to futures in other... or you can use it for implementing futures, which you also expect to return a value. So, okay. So... So then there are two, now how can a thread terminate? So there are two ways how there are at least two ways, and there are, one could say that there are two regular ways how a thread may terminate. And the first one is that the initial function call simply, so it runs to completion. So the initial function call terminates, and then that's it. So then this initial function call returns a value, and that is the value of the call. So that's fine. Then there is another way how a function, a thread could terminate, and that is if there is an exit. You could kind of call run into an exit statement, then the return value is the value provided by the exit. And that is, if a thread terminates, then and it has computed a value, then this value must be communicated to other potentially communicated to other to the surroundings, and that we will do. But for that we misuse the bottom stack cell. And that is for the return value of the master call, and there we will kind of return the return value. And that is kind of the place where we want to where the return value should sit. The other point is this exit thing is a little bit like an exception. So it is a particular form of exception. It means that all the stack frames in between must be kicked, must be deallocated, and then then this return value can be placed at the bottom of the stack, and then kind of the terminal treatment of the thread should be jumped to, and that we have decided to place at a fixed address F, this F for final. Okay, so that's kind of the way how we will deal with it. Then there is something like, one could also think of that there is a possibility of that one thread kills the other threads, so like killing. But that is kind of a dangerous thing. I think there was the suspend and resume and these things, which they also in the Java thread library were supported in the early editions and later abandoned because they are potentially dangerous and difficult, and therefore people did not consider that as useful and abandoned it. I don't know whether there's a suspend and resume in POSIX threads. I don't know. In object, in POSIX threads, you have no objects?
No, as an object, as a pointer. You have a pointer and you get the return value of the thread, whether it finishes or not. And I think you can kill it this way.
You can kill.
But with the resume and.
So let us see what we will do at an exit. So at an exit, so first we have to evaluate the expression, because that is the value which we would like to return. Then kind of whatever we will have to do. So there here I propose that we will have to do three activities. The first one is this exit thing to kind of pop the stack frames. Then there is an instruction term for the termination of the for the terminal treatment of the thread, which we will explain later, and then there is this next thing, which means that the current thread is kind of terminated and it is no longer in the current thread, so then the next thread should be taken out of the ready queue, and that is done by this next thing, which I will explain in a minute. So now let us see what kind of take a closer look at this exit thing. So this exit thing, how do we implement it? The result we assume is on top of the stack because that has been provided by the evaluation of E. So this we store in this intermediate variable result. And then while the frame pointer is different from -1, by minus FP equals -1, we identify the bottom of the stack. While that is the case, we kind of set the stack pointer to the frame pointer -2, frame pointer -2, and set the frame pointer as the content of the frame pointer -1. So by that we kind of set the we kind of kick off the organizational cells and the one stack frame and go to the ancestor stack frame. And once we are terminated with that, once this loop has been terminated, then the once this popping of the stack frame has been abandoned, has terminated, we then kind of just place into S of SP the result. So this, I guess this could also be simplified, I guess, by not modifying. Yeah, but that is the way how we could do it. Yeah, so by that we pop off all the stack frames and then return the result put into the bottommost stack element, stack cell. And the frame pointer at that point is -1, and the stack pointer points to this single base element of the stack. So now what does the instruction next do? I said that so the current thread has terminated. So now the next thread should be evaluated, and that is done by this instruction next. So the next thing, what does it do? The current thread is not inserted back into the ready queue. It is just skipped, and the first element of the ready queue is put into the CT, and the entry of that in the TTAP is put into is used to restore the registers SP, PC, and FP, and then operation proceeds. So in that sense, it's very very easy. And perhaps one could do also additionally save the elements, the current values of SP, PC, and FP into the TTAP. Also, one will not kind of also the content of the current current thread memory register is overwritten, and so the current thread is simply finished. So if the now what happens? There could be another thing that the ready queue is empty, and then that means there is nothing in the ready queue which we could make the new current thread, and in this case the whole program will terminate. So that means if we dequeue and find that the value is less than zero, then we simply halt, and otherwise we save the current thread, we make the dequeued element the new current thread, and restore its registers. Okay, so that was for the exiting, and now the question is what happens. Then there is, if a thread terminates, then there might be other threads who kind of wait for that event. This is this joining. This joining is also available in Java, and so this is the way how you can, the way to go. For example, if you kind of, you have spawned a thread to a helper thread to solve a subproblem, and then the helper thread has solved the subproblem, and you kind of want to have the result. So you expect the thread to return to you the result, which and now you cannot go on until the thread has provided the result. For that, you may join this you may want to join that thread, and this means your own execution is blocked until the thread has terminated. Then you receive the value, and then you can continue. Yeah. So that means our language may contain expressions of that form, join E. And that where the E should evaluate to a thread ID. So if you in Java, the E should evaluate to a thread object, and then you can kind of join that. So okay, so that means in detail, if the thread has already terminated, then this joining will kind of take the return value of the thread, and that will be the return value of the join. And if it has not yet terminated, then we have to wait until that has happened in order to kind of continue with the value. And so therefore, in this particular case, what do we do with this interrupted thread? We cannot put it into the ready queue because it is not ready for running, but this interrupted current thread must wait somewhere for termination. And therefore, we create a new thread queue where we can place the joining the threads waiting for termination. So this is this new issue which we have encountered here. We require a queue of these waiting threads. The current thread is entered there, and now our status, our three registers must be saved into the TTAP, and we have to switch to the next executable thread. So the next thread from the ready queue then will be running. Hopefully, some of these readily available threads will be the one we want to join with, and so hopefully this will at some point in time complete so that we may wake up. So that is, we save our status and switch to the next executable thread. And these threads which are waiting for termination are maintained in some table. We could kind of give the TTAP another entry which contains the threads waiting for termination of a particular thread, but here I kind of decided to create a new table. And I created this new table because it would be a rare event and only for some threads, other threads are waiting for termination. So here is this JTAP which we create, and this is a mostly empty table. So that would, therefore, we would not. While the TTAP we might consider as an array. This JTAP more. I would realize more conveniently as a hash table because it's almost empty. Yeah, but in principle, it implements a mapping from thread IDs to information relevant for the joining. And so these are two informations which one would like to have there. The first thing is one thing is, and the most important thing is, this queue of threads which wait for termination. So here in this particular situation, there is thread 1, and two threads are waiting for its termination, namely 2 and 3, and there is thread 3, and where thread 4 is waiting for its termination. And now the current thread is thread 0, and then there is also another thread waiting for, which is in the ready queue, so it could run, but is currently not running. So that is one entry. So I said this JTAP contains the queue of threads waiting for termination. And there's also another value which we can store there, namely the return value of threads, because that is a good thing. At that place, we put the information which all the other threads are waiting for. So if here is 17, then this means if we place 17 there and wake up 2 and 3, then 2 and 3 can retrieve the return value for the thread from that entry in the JTAP. So now what does join, how do we translate then join? The join E is translated in such a way that we first evaluate E, hopefully, to a thread ID. This is on top of the stack. Then comes, okay, so then we kind of have to inspect whether that thread is running or not. And that is kind of done by means of this instruction join. When we are done with the join, and when the join is done, then comes this finalize, and this finalize instruction will kind of prepare the state of the current thread in such a way that we can continue. In particular, it will kind of provide us with the return value of the thread with which we joined. So now, how is the join implemented? The join first assumes on top of the stack a thread ID, which is kind of stored here in this intermediate variable TID. Then it checks whether that thread with thread ID TID has terminated. How can we do it? So one possibility is that as we store the three, so if it is terminated, it is no longer running. If it's no longer running, then its three registers have been saved to the TTAP, and there we may inspect whether the frame pointer is -1. If the frame pointer is -1, all stack frames have been popped, and that means that the computation there has terminated. So this is a way how we communicate to the waiting threads that the thread has terminated. So this is our convention, and so TTAP gives us this information about termination. So if it has not terminated, so that means the frame pointer is at least 0, it's not negative, then okay, so what we can then we cannot proceed. We enqueue ourselves into the joining tab for this thread TID into the queue there by placing there this CT. Yeah, so by that we have enqueued ourselves, and then we kind of save our current thread state. This is a save thing, and kind of restore the next one which is taken from the ready queue, and that is our fabulous instruction next, which we kind of call here. Yeah, by that that means what we do. We kind of go to sleep. Okay, so now that is going to sleep, and at some point we hopefully get woken up again, and woken up again. This is, and then that means that the thread which has terminated, kind of, that is now the kind of the secret between this term instruction, which I have not yet explained to you. When a thread terminates, it has to kind of check. So then the last duty of a thread is to check, has somebody waited for my termination? And then the thread takes all these threads in the queue and puts them into the ready queue. And so now we are in the ready queue, and then we continue with this finalize instruction. And this finalize, what does it do? This finalize, what does it do? It finds on top of the stack, still the thread, the ID of the thread which we are joining with. And that we use to kind of retrieve from the JTAP the return value. So that is, we look up here in that actually here this TID is should perhaps this should be simply S of SP that we use that we look up the return value and write it on top of the stack, and that's it. So that gives us kind of this kind of gives us the translation of the join, and the only thing which we now have to kind of still refill in kind of back patch is the translation of this instruction term, which was the last instruction before the context switch from the terminated thread to the next one in the thread ID. And that, I think, for that the time is over today, but that with that we start next week. And so for today, thank you for your attention, and we meet again next Monday.